Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Ashley Nicole Black's job is to make us laugh and think, and she does this as a writer correspondent for Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, which, in case you didn't know, is the first political talk show not only hosted by a woman, but has the most diverse writing staff in late-night history. Briefly, Ashley grew up outside L.A. and majored in theater in high school. Despite auditioning for several college theater programs, she wound up not far from home at UC Santa Cruz because, she said, it was the only school that didn't pursue traditional casting. After graduating in 2007, it was on to Northwestern, where Ashley earned a master's in performance studies. But while in Chicago, she took an improv class at the Second City, which she said is where she found her voice. She began a PhD program in Chicago, finished her coursework over 4 years, but took a leave of absence before writing her dissertation. During that time, Ashley joined Second City's performance group. In 2012, she began teaching and writing there while performing around Chicago. In 2014, Ashley auditioned for An American Education, an ABC pilot that didn't get picked up. She moved back home, went on auditions, wrote pilots and spec scripts, and in August the following year, applied for a job with Full Frontal. And as they say, the rest is history. Oh, by the way, this year Ashley was nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Writing for a Variety Series. So Ashley, welcome and thanks for joining me today.
That's such a great intro, because when you tell it like that, it sounds like a success story. Living it was just a series of failures.
A whole different mindset. You know what? There's a lot to talk about, but I want to start with today and go backwards. So what's life like working in front of and behind the camera on Full Frontal with Samantha Bee?
It's great. I think I was always a person who thought a lot about politics and cared a lot about politics. And just that energy went nowhere. It was just like, oh, this thing is so frustrating. And now I just can open my computer and write those feelings down. And that's my job.
Like, yeah,
who
really
gets to do that?
But before it was almost that politics was boring and ho-hum.
Yeah, it wasn't funny, right?
It wasn't like, funny. You or it wasn't sad either.
You would like work to turn things into jokes. And now it's so heightened. Like a lot of comedy is just like taking something that happened and heightening it. That's not what we're doing in this election. Everything is so heightened that form of comedy isn't working anymore.
The pitch must be incredible. How did you get hired?
Okay, so
why did you get hired?
A friend of mine was invited to submit to the show through his manager. I wasn't represented at the time. And we had had a conversation about how women often don't get the opportunities to apply for these jobs. There have been a couple studies done, and agents and managers just don't represent as many women and people of color. And that's where networks go shopping for writers. So they tend to get mostly submissions from white male writers. So this guy had been invited to submit, and he was like, you know what, you're absolutely right. Women don't get these opportunities. This seems like a perfect opportunity for you. So he gave it to me. But because I didn't get it through the traditional channel, I had like 3 days before it was due.
Oh, God.
And I also had been commissioned to write a show that I'd been writing for months that was due on the same day as this packet. So I literally
that
just
seems
like,
awfully contrived. Yeah.
It's a real thing. This is how you know it's a real story, because I ended up writing it in a hotel room because I was traveling for that show, and I like ordered shrimp and wine from room service, and my memory of writing this packet is like 3 o'clock in the morning eating shrimp and writing it. So it's definitely a real story, because otherwise why? What kind of human lives that way? So I knew that I was like kind of sneaking my packet in because I hadn't officially been asked to submit.
Submit, yeah.
And so I, you know, just stayed up all night, wrote it, and was sort of like, all I hope for is that someone actually reads it and they don't just throw it out without reading it, which is what some shows would do.
Was it a natural act to write? Did it just sort of pour out of you?
For Sam, yes. I was, like, obviously familiar with Sam's work.
But sure.
The first step that I took of writing this packet was just watching everything she had done. And then having it on without watching it and just listening to her voice. And even, you know, I, like, didn't sleep much in those 4 days. But when I did, I, like, slept with
Her.
Her voice. Yeah. There's your pull quote. I slept like listening to her voice, and her voice was very natural for me. And one of the great things of coming out of the Second City is you really do learn how to write like for your voice and for other people's voices and how to take on that. And hers was just like very easy for me.
You submitted this, and then how long did it take before you got a callback?
I think like 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. It couldn't have been more than 2 weeks. It felt like 10 years.
I bet.
And then there was a second packet. So we did a second round of packets. And like one of my closest friends was applying, and everything that we apply for, we always read each other's stuff. And then the second packet.
You don't want to sabotage each other?
No, we give each other notes. And uh-huh. on the second packets, we're like, should we read these? Now we actually have a shot. Mm-hmm. But I think we still did. We give each other notes on everything. And then it was like pretty immediate. Like I had like 2 weeks to move to New York after I got the news that I got in the job.
From LA.
Yeah.
So this was the manna from heaven?
Yeah, I literally had no expectation that my packet would even get read, let alone that within a month I'd be moving across the country.
Did you, prior to that, work on projects as opposed to having a full-time job, going every day to the Jones Company or whatever?
Yeah, I was freelancing.
Freelancing and earning a living?
Yeah.
And also performing?
Yeah. So it was also like very compartmentalized, where like one of my freelance jobs was writing about politics, but writing about politics, not comedy. Mm-hmm, and then I would do comedy shows. And then I had also had a job where I was writing this play. But like it was like every piece of your creativity is in a different box.
Got it.
And then getting this job was like, oh, you can do all of those things in one place full time instead of like piecing together.
So you get hired in what year, what month?
I got hired in October and
of
I moved here.
15?
Yeah.
Of 2015.
And moved here in November.
And in November. And you didn't have a job similar to that experience. I mean, improv's one thing because it's collective on stage. It's not collective beforehand, right? So this must have been a really interesting experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Did I say that the right way?
I had written a lot of sketch comedy because that's what we do at the Second City. And a couple of years before, like maybe 2 years before this, I felt like joke writing was kind of my weakness. Mm-hmm. So I took a class on late night writing. And one of the things that the teacher suggested was just like every week, go through the news and write those jokes. And so I was kind of doing that by myself off to the side, you know, every now and then while I wasn't doing that as my job. But it was kind of like I'm a very competent sketch writer. Like I know how to write a sketch. And then the first big job that I get is like, it's just joke writing. It's just the thing that I identified as my weakest kind of
writing. That's crazy. So were you just completely unnerved by that?
A little bit. And then as soon as I got in there, it was like, oh, I know how to make comedy with a group of people. Like, it's a little intimidating. Everyone had been on The Daily Show and The Colbert Report and The Late Show. Mm-hmm. And it's a little intimidating to
walk
into
that room. So they were all repeat offenders.
Yeah.
A lot of them, I'm sure, had Second City backgrounds, too, or Upright Citizen Brigade
kind
of thing.
Yeah.
So just describe what the process is like. The show is on Monday nights, which is, in a sense, maybe not so unfortunate for you because you probably work so hard, but it's too bad it's not a five-night-a-week, you know, experience because she's so fabulous.
Yeah.
The show
Sam
is so
likes
great.
Hanging out with her kids. She's weird that way.
That's really fat.
So
what's the week like?
Well, so our week kind of begins and ends on Monday. So we shoot Monday afternoon, and that process is we do a rehearsal. So we have a finished script in the morning. We do a rehearsal.
But you're working on the script days before Monday.
Yeah. But to start with Monday and work backwards.
Okay.
So we do a rehearsal, and then after, you know, we do the whole show live, we go into a room and we rewrite the entire show joke for joke, and then shoot it. We shoot around 6:30 on Monday. And then on Tuesday and Wednesday, generally, we're doing research for the next week. So those days are a little bit lighter for us, and our research team is going crazy. They produce these amazing research packets. It's like the best thing in the world. Like when you're writing freelance, half your job is like doing the research to do the writing, and someone else is doing that half of the job.
Oh,
it's amazing. Mm-hmm. And then Thursday, Friday, we usually spend like very intensely writing.
You're basically living with each other on Thursday and Friday.
So usually two or three of us are assigned to the same piece, and we both write a full piece, and then our boss picks the best pieces and puts them together.
What's a full piece considered in terms of time?
Anywhere between 5 and I think the longest we've done is like 11 minutes. We have to do commercials, unlike John Oliver.
Right.
So we do have a limit to how long a piece can get.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Ashley Nicole Black, who is a writer and correspondent on Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. When you got hired, Ashley, did you know you were going to be in front of the camera too?
Not at all. And I think in retrospect, Sam knew, but I was hired as a writer. It was my intention to go do a writing job. And when they did what all employers do, and I hope people know this, a deep Google before they hired me, they found some videos of me performing, and Sam and Joe, our showrunner, really liked them. And so they'd mentioned that they'd, you know, seen me performing and loved it. And then I think Sam was just like waiting for the opportunity to come along to ask me to be a correspondent.
So unbeknownst to you,
yeah,
that you were going to have a dual role, which also must have been just so terrific when that happened for you.
Yeah, it's amazing. Writing for Sam is so great because she's so good. Like, you can write anything and she can
hit it out of the park.
You know it's going to happen. My experience was a lot of writing for myself because that's what we do at the Second City. And the challenge is different because it's almost like you're challenging yourself. Can mm-hmm. I do this?
Mm-hmm.
Can I, you know? And so getting to do both at the same time is really nice because you're working both of those muscles.
Were you worried in any way about working for a diva?
No, that's very real, but it doesn't tend to be women.
Yeah.
It doesn't tend to be women
because there aren't.
Yeah, there aren't any.
Yeah.
So you don't really worry about it. You just kind of expect being in this business that you're going to deal with some of that behavior.
And you have to have a thick skin.
Yeah, but my experience of that is mostly with men. So having a work environment with mostly female bosses is the best because we don't have to deal with any of what the majority of people in television are dealing with.
What's the percentage of male, female? Are there a lot of African-American minority people on this staff?
Yeah, our staff is very diverse in terms of race, gender, everything.
Age?
It's probably a little young, mm-hmm. but I think that's typical.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
We still have, I don't know this to be true, but I would imagine more than 50% of the people on our staff are men. But the fact that it's not 90% is still a big deal.
You know, 2 years ago, I was invited to attend the AOL Makers Conference in L.A. And it was a very interesting opportunity. I met some really terrific women, and there were a lot of very famous women. But I got to meet a woman who wrote for David Letterman. And I said, oh, I have a women's talk show. I'd love to interview you. And at first it was, sure. And then the more she thought about it, she said, I can't do this. And it was not that I was going to, you know, what's it really like to work for David Letterman? She was too nervous because she was an anomaly on that staff. And she would share stories of the guys, hey, everybody, let's go out and get a burger. And I'll make up her name. And Marianne wasn't, included in that. I mean, on the one hand, you sort of think that you died and went to heaven because you're working on Late Night with David Letterman. And oh, my gosh. And on the other hand, it wasn't great.
Yeah, I think it's getting a lot better because there are more and more women and there are more and more people of color. But it's really hard to not like hire and want to hang around with your friends. And I feel like a lot of those late night shows at the time, the network was very much this boys network of like, hey, I have a couple of jobs, who has friends? And they all hang out and have a great time. And oh, the network says we have to hire one woman, so we'll have her in. But she's not like in that friend group.
Mm-hmm. She's not in the inner circle, kind of.
Yeah. And I think that is changing because the audience wants to see themselves reflected in their comedy and what they want to relate to and laugh at. So you can't just have, 10 white guys who all went to Harvard and all grew up on the East Coast couldn't possibly write something that's going to reflect the reality of the majority of the country.
For sure.
And so I think that is why that's starting to change, because the audience is demanding it.
What was it like for you growing up in terms of finding your own voice and getting out there? Were you mentored? Did you experience rejection just in terms of people not taking your comedy seriously?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was very lucky that I grew up with parents who sort of expected when they moved us out to the suburbs that we're going to be some of the only black kids in town and you guys have to be ready to stand up for yourself and speak for yourselves. And so they were very supportive and also very like, if there was ever a problem, you have to deal with it.
Mm.
You have to learn how to speak up for yourself. So we grew up in like a really great, really nice, very racially diverse neighborhood with not a lot of black people, but always with teachers who would say, I was also, this is one of those things women aren't supposed to say, but exceptionally smart. And so I would get teachers being like, well, you couldn't have possibly written this paper because how could you have possibly done this? There's a lot of that. So you sort of grow up knowing I'm going to have to fight.
Keep proving myself?
Yeah, I'm going to have to fight for my words every time. And so when I came into comedy, it was on the one hand incredibly welcoming because I was funny and people are looking for funny people to make money off of and great. But on the other hand, there was a lot of like, we want you to be this person. Like I was asked, like, why don't you play more angry, sassy characters? Or one time I was asked, why don't you talk more about growing up in the hood? And I'm because I grew up in Orange County. And so I can. But that experience of like, oh, I'm going to have to fight for my truth and for my words wasn't brand new. So I think I was able to like survive
it
a little bit more.
Sense.
Yeah, because we were raised with the expectation that that was going to happen.
Did anybody mentor you when it came to theater or whatever? I mean, it was just this innate sense that you had, I'm funny, I'm clever, I could do this.
My parents definitely did not want us to go into like artistic things. So to me, like theater was always like your side hobby that you do, but not something that could be a job. So I wasn't really looking or finding like a mentor to like help me continue in that as a kid. Because I thought like band, like not everyone who does band is going to be a professional musician.
For
it's
sure.
just something you do for fun. So I really didn't find that. I maybe also wasn't super looking for it because in Black families, it's like you could be a doctor, you could be president, or you could be a lawyer. And those are your options. And if you want to do some plays in the meantime, that's fine.
Okay, fine. You know, I had said in the intro that you picked UC Santa Cruz because it didn't pursue traditional casting. So expound on that a little bit.
Yeah. So I visited a bunch of colleges and in all of them, you know, they have pictures of the past productions on the walls and all the casts were all white. And for me, like, even though I still wasn't admitting to myself that I wanted to do theater as a career, I wanted to do it in college. And I was like, well, if all of these casts are all white, what are my chances of getting on stage? And I saw that like school after school after school. So finally I visited USC. And there was a Black woman who was like doing the administrative part of the tour. And so I felt comfortable asking her and I asked her, hey, I notice all the pictures, all the people in all the pictures are white. And she's like, yes, they do traditional casting. So if they do a show that has a family in it, it's going to be an all white family and you will probably get to do a show once a year during Black History Month. And I was like, thank you for letting me know. And UC Santa Cruz was the only school that was crowing about doing non-traditional casting. Yeah. So I have a shot. You know, who knows if I have the talent or if I'm good enough or whatever. But the opportunity will be there for me to get on stage. I'm not going to be automatically disqualified.
So then what propels you to go to Northwestern? And I mean, why did you want a master's?
I was a child and not smart. And I like didn't know what I wanted to do.
Like that didn't make you not smart. You weren't maybe savvy.
Yeah. Maybe? So I had one professor who was like, well, you're smart. You should go to grad school. And I was like, cool. That's what I'll do. Because I didn't know. And Northwestern was the best program for performance studies. And it was a good way to like leave home and have a thing to do as opposed to like be immediately looking for a job and that thing that everyone's worried about after college. So I went. And their program is really geared towards like getting a PhD and becoming a professor and sort of very quickly realized that while I enjoyed studying and I enjoyed what I was learning, I didn't want to be a professor. And so I was sort of pursuing something that I didn't want. And then luckily for me, at the same time, I started taking classes at Second City and kind of finding.
Did you know about Second City while you were growing?
No.
You didn't.
That's
interesting.
I knew nothing. And this is how naive I was. One of the president of Second City, Kelly Leonard, when I had first gotten there, and most people, it's like their dream and they've been seeing shows for years and they're kind of known. And I just kind of like came onto the scene. And I think people immediately recognized me as very funny, but also like, where did this girl come from? So Kelly Leonard, the president of Second City, takes me to lunch and is like, so, you know, how did you end up here? Was Second City your dream? And stupid me goes, I'd never heard of Second City. IO was full and there was still room at Second City. So I came. And the look on his face, I was like, oh, that was an impolite thing to say. But I had no idea. And my colleagues in my class,
well, that must have been refreshing on some level.
Yeah. You know. It was honest.
Let's try and put a positive spin on that. But it worked. It worked in your favor.
Yeah. And I had never really had a knowledge of sketch comedy. And so that was, you know, in the thing, it says, like, that's how I found my voice. I was like, oh, this is how I've been looking for how to express myself. And I tried everything. I done musical theater. I'd done theater. I'd done improv. I'd done everything. And sketch was like, oh, this is what I've been trying to do. I've been trying to find a way to write my own words and perform them and impact people in the way that, for me, only comedy can.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Ashley Nicole Black, who is a writer and correspondent on Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. What's your bent? What's your thing? Or does one have to have a thing when it comes to comedy?
I don't know if this, it's not inherently funny, but my thing is, I think, one, recontextualizing things, and two, a radical honesty. Because I think we're so used to seeing Black people in these, like, types of characters, that to see a Black person come on stage and just fully be themselves and not embody a type is already super radical. And some of the humor will just come out of the, like, surprise of, I can't believe that just happened. This wasn't what I was expecting. Mm-hmm. So I think my thing is always to just be 100% honest and real about whatever that thing is. So that applies to when I'm performing, but it also applies, you know, like when I write for Sam, I am writing 100% my honest opinion about that thing. And it's just so rare that you hear someone's fully unfiltered, honest opinion that a lot of times that's very funny.
Well, you know, that leads into a great thing because the piece that you did on Full Frontal at the RNC, interviewing delegates, I guess, you know, about Black Lives Matter. Set that scene because it's a great piece.
Yeah, so that was my first time being a correspondent.
You're kidding. I didn't know that. At the RNC?
At the RNC. Okay. And I think we thought what that piece was going to be was like, we'd ask people, will you say Black Lives Matter? And they'd insist on saying All Lives Matter. And then we'd cut that together and that would be funny and that would be what it was. Because I'm also a writer, I got to the RNC a day late because we were writing. And so the two other correspondents who are both white, that was basically the experience that they had. And then I came in and it was like, okay, quick, you know, they had been shooting for 2 days. You quickly go out and like get the same material and then we'll cut it together. Mm-hmm. And that's not what happened. Like when a Black person is in front of you, it's a lot harder to just be completely dismissive of a thing. So what ended up happening was I was having these long, deeply emotional conversations with people who didn't want to be or didn't want to be seen as hateful, but also had a lot of misinformation. And so in their mind, they're like, if these people are killing all these people, committing all these crimes, how can we not hate them? And it's hard to make a joke when what you need to tell that person is, that's not true. They're not killing all these people. They're not committing all the crimes. And don't you want to know that it's not true and release this burden of like, why are people calling me racist for hating the people who are doing the things that, as it turns out, they're not doing? So it turned into 3 days of just deeply emotional conversations with, I would say, 95% of people wanted to understand. And I was perhaps the only person they'd had to ask directly.
And who's African-American?
Yeah. There are so many books and articles and things they could choose to read, but they didn't. And it wasn't until they met a Black person at the RNC that they got to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, 5% of people were deeply, terribly, irredeemably racist. But the majority of people just like wanted to understand and had not yet had the opportunity to have a personal conversation with someone. So what we went in to like do this light piece turned into like 3 days of emotional slog.
Wow. Wow.
And I was happy that we edited it together and showed that reality instead of, I mean, we could have still cut together a piece where people just say All Lives Matter and like, look how silly these people are. But I was really proud that we edited it together in a way that honored that they were conflicted and they had real emotions and they weren't just being unempathetic or dismissive. They had misinformation and didn't know what to do with it.
So it's more than just getting out there and doing comedy because it's much more impactful. It's much more potent.
I had obviously only ever seen it done because I hadn't done it before, but I didn't realize how much, and I should have, how much having my body was going to affect that process. So there are things that when the other correspondents go out, they get straightforward answers. And when I go out, I'm going to get a slanted version of that answer because they're talking to a Black person. So I like sort of didn't go in knowing that that was going to be part of the work. And that's just like changes the way you're able to make comedy, which in a very interesting way.
I want to reference a great moment for you. I'm calling it a seminal moment in your life. that you got, unbeknownst to you,
yes,
you got to do face-to-face with the man of your dreams, mm-hmm, New Jersey's junior senator, Cory Booker. And so Samantha worked it out that you were going to, unbeknownst to you, that you were going to get to meet him and that that was going to be shot.
Yeah, the whole staff
at the
knew.
DNC, correct?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. The whole staff knew, and I had no idea. And I was like, also, I was wearing a mic and like complaining. I'm somewhere there exists a recording of me being like, ugh, why are they making me wait? What is going on?
You mean that she wanted to see you, kind of thing?
Yeah, I was just told to like, you're going to do something. I didn't know what it
here.
Is. Hang out over here, mm-hmm, and wait.
And so you're getting pissed off.
No, just like, what is happening? Mm-hmm. And then walked in and Cory Booker was there. And I just like, I grew up in Los Angeles. My dad's a musician. I'm not a person who like freaks out to meet celebrities, mm-hmm, or public figures. Mm-hmm. It's very normal for me. Meeting Cory Booker, my entire body was shaking. My heart was racing. I've never experienced that feeling before. And I'm sure that's just what people feel when they meet a celebrity. Mm-hmm. But since I am not that person, I was like, maybe this is what falling in love is.
Or having a heart attack.
Yeah. One of those two things.
Uh-huh. And I mean, he was so gracious. I mean, yeah, he's a great guy.
The sweetest guy. And he...
Did he take your number?
Yes.
Because you wanted to text each other, right? I mean, he took your number, right?
Yeah. I mean, he texted, I watched this piece. You're amazing. I watched the show. It's great. Like, that's...
What are your other fantasies while we're at it?
Oh, gosh.
We've got time.
You know, I think people always ask, like, what do you want to do next? Do you want to have your own late night show? And I think the fantasy version would be having a show like a 30 Rock or a Mindy Project. So my fantasy is total control, mm-hmm, you know, to be able
but
to.
But you could do it all.
Yeah. To write and produce and act and just have total control over an expression is something that's like a fantasy.
And could it be a reality?
I think it's possible. Yeah, mm-hmm, it's happened. It's happening more and more. I think not too long ago, we didn't have an example where a woman had gotten to do that. Mm-hmm. And now we have several. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you also on a personal note, are you working on other things on the side? Do you have time to do that, to kind of explore other passions that you might have connected to comedy? I mean, would you love, for example, would you like to do stand-up?
I don't enjoy doing stand-up because I don't enjoy doing comedy alone. So that's the main
it's
difference
collaborative
in what
you.
We do. Yeah, is that, mm-hmm, stand-ups work alone, and they work really, really hard, and it's just not a style for me. I do try to work on other projects. We don't have a lot of time, so that's like the one thing. You know, I moved here and immediately had this job, so it took me a little while to like get settled.
Do you like it here?
I do now. When I first came, I was like, everything tastes bad, which may have been emotional. And I've come to learn the city and to love it. But doing that and also getting used to a job, I'm like just at the point now where it's like, maybe I could dust off these old projects, but there's not a lot of time right now. And I do love it. But coming, I mean, I lived in LA for years, obviously, and I lived in the Midwest for years.
Mm-hmm.
And
big cities.
Yes. So yeah, I've lived in big cities, but the New York thing, it's a whole other thing.
Vibe. Like, oh,
I remember
absolutely.
When I first moved, my bodega near my apartment, I like couldn't get a sandwich because I was just like politely waiting in line and everyone else was just walking in front of me and yelling for a sandwich. And then every time I would finally get something, I'd say, thank you. And they would look at me like I was a monster. So I had to learn, like, if you want a sandwich, you just got
to
go.
And elbow your way up to the front. Oh, that's so great. Is it living the dream?
It is. And every now and then I just like stop and I'm like, this is my life. Like the other day I had to shut down a social media account because I was getting too many emails, like positive and negative, but emails from strangers. And I was like, oh, I got to shut this down. And then I like stopped to be like, what a blessing. Like, how dare you be annoyed that people are trying to contact you and talk to you about your work? Like, this is the dream.
Mm-hmm.
But I have that moment like once a week. Like, mm-hmm, once a week, I'm just like, I can't believe this is my life.
Ashley, thank you so much for taking the time out of your really busy schedule to come and have a conversation with me. It was so interesting. You're so easy. It was really a lot of fun. Thank you. And much continued success.
Thank you.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women, and please go to our iTunes store page and leave a rating and a review. And if you know anyone you think that we should interview, contact us at sandyclineshow.com.